Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Nathan Hill, author of The Knicks, just published on the 30th by Knopf. It has so much pre-publication publicity that the press kit I received took me an hour to read. And before it was even released, it's been translated into German, Dutch, French, Spanish, including Catalan, Danish, Swedish, Norwegian, which is important, Italian, Finnish, Hebrew, Hungarian, Korean, Polish, and Chinese. I mean, what the hell is up with that? I can only imagine the feeding frenzy for the movie rights. But so Nathan is an associate professor of English at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, from which position he's taking a break in order to pursue his writing, which seems very logical to me. His short stories have been published in the Iowa Review, Fugue, the Gettysburg Review, and many others. He lives now in Naples, Florida, but has spent most of his life in the Midwest. The Knicks is a novel with a roadmap for its epigraph, which is the story of the blind men and the elephant, as originally recounted by the Buddha. What we as individuals take for reality is not that which others do. It may be true for us, but so there are many truths. And in a more inductive sense, many of us, undiscerning, unrealizing, let one drop of water be our universe, when that drop can fall into a bucket, and that bucket can be poured into an endless sea. So whether one is lost in a video game, a doppelganger for real as opposed to a virtual life, or whether one lives in a past that inhibits growth, that shames or paralyzes future movement, we all live inner lives, not necessarily of quiet desperation, but many of the characters in this book sure do. What makes The Knicks different than other novels that deal with mother-son estrangement, or with the political processes in America, or with unrequited love, or with dark secrets, too secret to reveal, or with missed opportunities, is that it seamlessly weaves all of these themes into a work that exceeds the sum of its parts. And in so doing, we find ourselves caught up in a web of words, and with a story so resonant, so close to home, that when we finish, we as readers have the opportunity and, yes, the responsibility of reexamining our own lives, sometimes painfully, and kind of provides us the Pandora-like opportunity to discover our own Knickses. So welcome, Nathan, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. That was an amazing introduction. I feel like I don't need to say anything.
All right, goodbye.
it's all going to be downhill from here.
Well, actually, the question I have of you is, having lived with this, your own Knicks in a way for 10 years, Do you find yourself after all, especially in this frenzy that's been created, that you never expected, do you find yourself revisiting your own life and the course which it's taken since the book borrows, if you will, so much from your own existence?
It's true that a lot of this just seems sort of happenstance I decided to take a teaching job many years ago which led into a sort of teaching career and you know that provided a lot of the fodder for the Knicks, I'd run across something in my daily life and it would become part of the book, and all of that just seems like chance or happenstance. I guess is one way to look at it. Mostly, I look at it as, you know, the world gives you the fodder, gives you the grist for the mill, and you just allow it to penetrate you. And so a lot of the things that I was confused about or nervous about or worried about or angry about over the something like 10 years I was writing the book just ended up making their way into the novel. It was just, I sort of stuffed everything into it.
Yeah, the funny thing is, like Elfscape or like Minecraft or World of War or something like that.
Yeah.
You pick up the New York Times and John Irving is saying you're Charles Dickens. Isn't that like beyond what you ever expected?
I'll have to admit to some giddiness and some sort of giggling when that story came out. I couldn't believe that he had said that. That was incredibly nice of him. When I was working on this book, I had sort of dropped out of the whole, you know, publication thing. Like I wasn't querying, I wasn't sending stuff out. I was just sort of quietly working. And the only person who knew a thing about the book was my wife. I give her kind of daily updates, and she would listen to my pages, and that was it for years. That was it. And you know, so you work on something for so long, and you don't show anybody what you're doing. There's this worry kind of gnawing at the back of your head that like what you're doing is just not going to make any sense to anyone. I thought, you know, I'd give the book to my agent, and it would just kind of land with a thud and maybe leave a me-shaped hole in the floor. And so the fact that it's, you know, getting this recognition and people seem to really like it, is really beyond everything I had ever hoped for. I have to pinch myself sometimes.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I've been thinking about what it would do to me, and it's not like winning the lottery. It's like being in a dream. To me, that's what it would feel like.
It's funny, you know, like it sort of has that quality, and then there are, you know, other moments where, you know, everything's very, very normal. Like for example, this morning, we're actually talking, you're catching me on publication day. The book comes out today. And this morning I like swept the floor in my kitchen, you know, and made oatmeal, you know, so in certain ways, like, there is nothing, you know, on a day-to-day, you know, in a day-to-day way, there's nothing really different at all. But then, you know, I turn on the computer and see Twitter blowing up, and it feels, you know, radically different indeed.
And also, this probably is the last day that, well, you have your whole tour scheduled, but, you know, you're going to be a different person now, at least, and it goes along with your book. You're going to be perceived differently than how you perceive yourself.
Yeah, it's weird. I've thought a bit about that. You know, a lot of the book has to do with kind of the nature of image creation, and how kind of snap judgments tend to be really, really wrong once you kind of dig down underneath them. And I mean, it's also, you know, very critical of sort of like mass media and kind of contemporary marketing. And so the fact that a lot of this stuff is now happening to the book that attempts to critique that very thing is maybe a paradox that I want to spend too much mental time with. But we'll see what happens. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, let's see if you ever become a crawl at the bottom of some CNN or MSNBC. That would do it for me.
That would be amazing.
It'll happen. Stuff like that's going to happen. You know, it's funny because, you know, I read in one of your interviews how, because so much of it is so close to home for you, especially, and we can talk about the video playing, role-playing games, you had to tell, you talked about how you had to tell your mom, it's not about you, Mom.
Oh, yeah.
Did she believe you?
She did, yeah. The mom in the book, you know, she leaves her family when her son is 11 years old and kind of almost like never to be heard from again. When she's with her family, she's a very distant, very cold person, but my mom is not. My mom is you know, always stuck around. She's still here, and she's a wonderful, supportive, you know, she was the first one to text me some congratulations this morning. But I had to warn her. I was like, you know, Mom, like when you read this character, it's going to feel really familiar, because when I needed a mom detail, I would reach from real life, you know, whenever it was appropriate. And so the mom in the story, in the book, shares her biography, but it's definitely not her. It's something I actually had to tell a lot of people, like, you know, friends that I knew would like recognize certain details in the book. I had to warn them ahead of time, you know, I got this detail from you, but then I twisted it and made it really ugly, so sorry about that, and that's not you, but that's what I do.
Well, what's so funny is, you know, Samuel kind of does the same thing. You know, Samuel, when he writes about Bethany and Bishop, he's essentially betraying them, which, you know, but he's not. It's like when Hemingway wrote The Sun Also Rises, he kind of did the same thing. And it's like you're, and he was forgiven, and Samuel was forgiven for that. And I'm not suggesting that you did anything like that. I'm just saying it's interesting that there's a parallel there. And for me, with Samuel having the same name as me, I mean, I cry at McDonald's commercials.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah, and I agree with Einstein that patriotism is an infantile disease like measles, but I still cry at the national anthem.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So are you like that? I mean, a little bit like Samuel?
I don't have the kind of cry trigger that he has. I mean, he's right on the edge all the time. But that is, I mean, partly, like, my family is sort of, we're prone to crying, you know. My two sisters, myself, my parents, like, we not for everything, but we're not shy about our emotions, you know. Just like a week and a half ago, I was with my sister who's an optometrist, and she's opening up her own optometry practice, and I was there for the ribbon cutting. And she was thanking everybody, and everything was going fine, and then she turned to her husband to thank him and immediately started crying, as did just about everybody in our family. So it's like little, you know, like they're specific individual triggers that will get us, but when they get us, they get us good.
Yeah, but they get you based on love.
Yeah.
And Samuel's,
yeah, that'll do it.
Samuel's almost the opposite, right? I mean, it's this fear of not meeting up to someone's expectations, which is drawn down from generations, as you talk about in the book. So you're crying, like, if you go to a wedding, or if I cry when I see my daughter perform,
yeah.
And I do. Those are from love.
Yeah.
Samuel's is a different kind completely, right?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was listening to my sister talking, I welled up when she started talking about, like, you know, like she specializes in a certain kind of optometry that helps people who can't find help anywhere else. And that I was like, oh, she helps people. And I just immediately started welling up. But Samuel, you're right. It's much more about being judged. It's much more about being afraid. It's much more about kind of letting people down, not meeting their expectations, even if those expectations have been constructed entirely in his own head, which, you know, most of us do all the time. We're much more worried about pleasing our perception of what other people want of us rather than what they might actually want of us. And that's Samuel's issue. You know, he senses something's going on with his mom. He can't quite put his finger on it, and so it worries him terribly.
I think that, you know, when I read your book, I thought, like everybody else, I'm thinking of Thomas Pynchon, I'm thinking of John Barth, I'm thinking of John Irving, I'm thinking of Don DeLillo a little bit.
Yeah.
And the thing about it is that what they do and what you do too is, like, for several things. One thing is, you have Samuel, you have his mother, and you have her father, and they all three manifest the same thing in different ways. Samuel cries, Faye has her panic attacks, and Faye's dad just looks out. Isn't that strange? You know,
I like the idea of regret sort of manifesting as a physical thing. You know, that for people who kind of internalize regret or internalize worry or anxiety so much that maybe they're not even connecting with it emotionally anymore, that it would have to come out in some way, and making it physical was the way I kind of made it come out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. In fact, their coping mechanisms are somewhat similar. Like when Samuel's talking to Laura and he's being very, very matter-of-fact about it, almost with this undercurrent of humor when you read it. And then towards the end, when Faye I'm not going to get into any spoilers, but towards the end, when Faye does what she does, she almost sounds like a very dry comedian in some of the things she's saying. And that seems to be the method in which she's found to cope with a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, her problem is that she thinks she missed out on a life that she should have had. You know, that she went in one direction, which is kind of she decided to have a family and marry someone that maybe she wasn't entirely in love with, move to the suburbs and have this one kind of middle class life, when maybe she thought she should have had another life altogether, and that regret just kind of builds and builds and builds in her.
And then, and I have the same feelings, and I'm sure you do too. Or, you know, it's the road not taken, or the door that you didn't open, or when you write. Talk about Samuel and the books he writes that are like many of the books in my bookstore that have different paths that you can choose. And how you did the separate section with a separate font.
The Choose Your Own Adventure section. Do you sell a lot of those books still?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm really happy that those are still popular. I fell in love with Choose Your Own Adventure books in the 80s when they were published by Bantam. I kind of made my own way as a reader, you know, I just sort of picked out whatever looked fun for me to read, and my parents would get it for me. It was funny. They wouldn't indulge me in like Star Wars characters, but if I asked for a book, they'd always say yes. So I asked for a lot of books. Those Choose Your Own Adventure books were like, you know, they're like games, you know, like, you know, I'd put my thumb at a certain decision and flip ahead to see if I was making the right decision and then come back and I always felt like there was like a platonically perfect and ideal way to go through every book, and it was my job to find it.
Yeah, and it's funny when you do it, you really got me at a couple of times where I kind of like, it wasn't that I was pissed off, but it was like, now turn the page to see whether Samuel, and I expected to see what he did, and then I didn't see what he did for a long time. It was like,
oh yeah,
and I was going, yeah. I was like really caught up in it. I want to see because Bethany is like this not goddess. Bethany is like this thing that all guys dream of, and you make that very clear. And through all her three or four phases, she still remains that, although, and again, this is why the book's so good, is because she manifests her beauty and her goodness in three or four different ways, right?
Thanks, yeah. The idea for that chapter happened because, well, I mean, first, obviously, I'd already mentioned that he enjoyed the Choose Your Own Adventure book, so the idea was already sort of in my head, but then I decided to make one big section of the book, a Choose Your Own Adventure, because it's this moment that and you know this, it's this moment that he's regretted. He thinks he had one shot to get this girl Bethany, and he blew it. And so he keeps thinking, well, what if I'd made a different choice? What if I'd done something differently? And in that way, it's like almost like a Choose Your Own Adventure. He wishes he could, you know, go back to where he held the page with his thumb and choose differently. But in the moment, it doesn't feel like that. In the moment, it doesn't feel like you have any choices. He's just kind of getting swept along by the current of the moment. That's why it's like the font and it's written in second person, so it's meant to mimic a Choose Your Own Adventure book, but it doesn't actually have any choices for you to make. You just kind of go along with it until the very end when there's a big doozy.
I was glad I didn't have to make a choice.
Yeah.
I really was. I was thinking, am I going to have to pick? Because I didn't want to. But, you know, but, you know, again, without giving anything away, but in terms of making promises or keeping wishes, it's like if Max Brod had listened to Franz Kafka and burned all of his stuff, then we wouldn't have the trial and we wouldn't have America. Yeah. And so sometimes maybe it's best to just say, go with your gut on those things and look how much the world is better for the fact that those books exist.
Yeah.
But only because someone broke a very important promise.
Well, and it's possible that his screwing up with Bethany was maybe the best thing to happen for them. Maybe. I mean, I don't want to give away the ending, but you know, like, you know, he said all guys have that sort of, you know, that crush, that early crush that just stays with you. And the thing about that crush is that it's sort of, you know, it's not real. You know, you're seeing an image of that person, or you're seeing what you think that person can do for you, but you're not seeing them in any way, like who they actually are. You know, you're not seeing them as the puzzle that they are. And so, you know, his desire for her was really just a reflection of his own ego, and I think that's maybe what he learns by screwing up so badly.
Well, that brings us to this, what we were talking about before the show started, is the people you meet in life, and Ponage, whose name I am pronouncing correctly only because you told me how to, Because I didn't know.
Do you know where that word comes from? Pwn, no. To pwn?
Nope.
Okay, so it's spelled P-W-N. And I had never encountered this word before I started playing online video games. But the legend goes that the word pwn came from early days of online gaming, like PC gaming, when, you know, if I would beat somebody really badly, I might write, "I just owned you." But then the P key is right next to the O key on all standard keyboards, and so that word was often misspelled. I just pwned you, P-W-N. And the internet being the internet, it just kind of stuck. So now to pwn someone is to defeat them utterly at a video game. And anybody who plays games long enough knows this word.
It's so funny, like the first meme, the first viral.
Right, exactly.
Well, so go ahead, talk about Pwnage's interpretation of both in real life. Well, I don't even know. He couldn't tell between real life, but his explanation to Samuel as to the types of people you meet in life.
Well, his whole philosophy of life comes from a video game and the four kinds of the four kinds of challenges you will find in a video game are puzzles. Let me see: enemies, obstacles, puzzles, and traps. And so he thinks this is also true in real life, that any person you meet in real life is either an enemy, an obstacle, a puzzle, or a trap. And so with enemies, you have to dispatch of them somehow in order to overcome them. With obstacles, you have to find your way around them. And with puzzles and traps, I think he says something like, those are hard to distinguish. Sometimes you think someone's a puzzle until you realize they're a trap, but that's by then it's too late, and that's the trap. So it's kind of true for everybody else in the novel. It was a clean way to be able to talk about, you know, some of the other characters in the novel and the way they see the world. Like a lot of the characters, especially at the beginning of the novel, see the world as full of enemies or full of traps or full of obstacles. And I think the argument of the book is maybe seeing the world as a puzzle or seeing people as puzzles is maybe a healthier way to live than seeing them as enemies or obstacles or traps.
And that's another thing that the book does. It's like the event horizon collapses, because when Pwnage says that, you realize that's the book right there, what he says.
Right.
That's
the entire... I was actually thinking of titling the book Enemy, Obstacle, Puzzle, Trap, and then decided no one could remember that.
Well, if you call it the Knicks, though, 10% are going to think it's about the basketball team, too, so...
Yeah, I have to, when I say it out loud, I have to spell it to people. They're like, the Knicks? They're like, no, it's N-I-X.
But yeah, the way he, and this is the thing I said before, if you figure out a puzzle that's not a trap, because that's really a dangerous place to be in life, when you're trying to figure out a puzzle who turns out to be in trap, because then there's really no way out. And that's a lot of psychological trauma, which goes exactly to Samuel Fay, Bishop, Charlie Brown. They all fall into traps.
That's exactly right. Wow, I wish, could you be the spokesperson for this book from now on? That's exactly right.
But, so what I was saying, was trying to trick you, was like, okay, so if a puzzle becomes a friend because you figure he or she out, then that's the fifth person you meet.
Oh, I see. I don't know. I feel like friends are constantly puzzles, because, you know, like a friend... you know, like everybody contains these layers and contains these multitudes that there's always some delight in figuring out. And even when you think you have them pinned down, you know, they wiggle out and become some new person. You know, I think especially, you know, friends, spouses, I think they're always puzzles. I think it's just that same category, but the nature of the puzzle changes depending on the friendship or the relationship.
Which, again, leaks over in other aspects of the book. Like, if you take Laura, for example, mm-hmm. You can talk about the social game, not game, but communication method, like Snapchat or whatever, which is called iFeel. And mm-hmm. there you go. I have this friend who has 22,000 followers. He thinks of them as friends. They're not friends. They're nothing.
22,000, wow.
So, and the autopilot aspect. Why don't you talk about, well, first of all, let's talk about Laura later, but talk about that program and the canned responses.
her social app, iFeel.
Yeah, iFeel, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's I wanted to invent a social media app for the book. I didn't want to have to be beholden to, you know, Facebook or Snapchat and anything, these things that are real and have real rules. I wanted it to be a little more flexible, so I invented an app called iFeel where its users can broadcast their emotions at any given moment. So they're like, I feel happy, I feel sad, or one of the other, like there are 50 standard emotion choices that they're allowed to choose, and then they can explain why they're feeling that and so forth. So it's sort of, I don't know, just a stand-in for social media, but also a bit of a gag in that, you know, when one of your friends chooses to post their emotions, you can respond, ignore, or auto care. And if you auto care, then the app will kind of just take care of responding for you. It seemed to, that the auto care to me seemed to sort of capture what it feels like to, you know, like somebody's post on Facebook or on Twitter. You know, it's a kind of connection, but it's so mediated that the connection is maybe dubious. And also the you know, the 50 standard emotion choices, I wanted to sort of just, maybe it's a joke about, you know, the social media apps. I don't know, you know, they all carry their own sort of socially regulated rules and norms about what you can say and what maybe you shouldn't say on Facebook or on Twitter, you know, who's good at Facebook and who's not. And these things sort of rein you in. You're not allowed to be your full human expressed self on Twitter or on Facebook. It's a sort of mediated self. And so, you know, it's it's just a restating probably of the old McLuhan thing about the medium is the message, but I feel like, you know, social media kind of requires you to be a sort of person on social media that maybe you aren't in real life. Like, for example, on Twitter, I use way more exclamation points on Twitter than I do in real life. But that's sort of how you have to write on Twitter to, you know, to kind of accord to the standards of that community. So, you know, it's a sort of mediated, it's sort of a mask. And so the fact that Laura can only choose from 50 emotions, and then at one point in the book she feels like she's feeling an emotion that is not expressible in iFeel, and she kind of doesn't know what to do with that. It sort of just grips her and terrifies her for a moment.
Yeah, I hate when I'm old, so like when someone asks me how I'm doing and I say great, I know that if I don't put an exclamation point, they'll either think I'm angry at them or I'm not.
Yeah, or you're being sarcastic.
Yeah, yeah. And so you have to, this exclamation point thing has to be used to denote that you're still liking, involved with, or this concept of ghosting, like your girlfriend breaks up with you by not responding. I mean, what the hell is happening to us? The thing that was so cool, what you did with Laura, is, and this is again one of the really great things about the book, is Laura. You should think about her a straight, certain way, a transparent, two-dimensional way. But when you have her with that situation where she can't think of the emotion and she's kind of second-guessing, almost getting to the point where she realizes who she is, you have her throw the paper clips in the air. And when you have her throw the paperclips in the air, you realize that she has this cognitive ability. And it's just a question of, instead of being pushed in one way by her mother or by the politically correct university, that if she were just left to her own devices, you know, she could spend her life wondering, can I throw these paperclips in such a way? Am I wrong about that?
They would go up and down as a single aggregate mass.
Yeah.
That's great. My thinking about Laura was that, honestly, when I first started writing her, I was writing her in response to several students I had at that point recently, who were, I taught writing in universities for like 10 years. In that time I encountered more students than I would have ever guessed at the beginning of my career that plagiarized their papers, cheated on tests, didn't really see anything wrong with that. Not all of them, obviously. Most students are really hardworking and wonderful, but enough that when I would talk to my other friends about it, we would feel like there was some kind of epidemic going on, like there was something generationally wrong And so I started writing her as a sort of reaction to that and a frustration with that. And honestly, I was kind of writing her to just create a hateable character. She was just, just an outlet for me. And then, as you know, usually happens when I spend a lot of time with a character, I started really liking her the more I wrote her, and I started feeling sort of sympathetic towards her, and then empathetic, and I started thinking, well, why? What is it about her life that makes her want to cheat on all of her papers and cheat her way through college? And the more time I spent with her, the more I softened towards her. And I hope that's evident in the book too, that transformation. Now, you know, after the whole thing, now she's actually one of my favorite characters. I think she might be like the smartest person in the book.
You could do a sequel just about her and the transformation in her life because of some seminal event that happens to her. But
what happens, fast forward 30 years as she runs for president.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. Because that's what I was just thinking in my head, that she's much better than Donald Trump. It definitely came across as a change in terms of, I didn't want to like her. I mean, I wasn't designed to like her, but you made me feel the way you felt as you made your transition. I remember when I was in college and I was taking this honors course in James Joyce Ulysses, and if I got an A in it, I would have a 3.5, so I would graduate college with a high honors. And I didn't think I was going to get an A. And I remember going to the professor's office and, I got to get this A. You've got to give me an A. Because if I don't get an A, and then I thought of my father, would he be disappointed if I didn't get high honors and all? And the professor was like, you know, I don't really care. You want an A? I'll give you an A. Fine. And I realized, you know, what a jackass I was being, you know?
This is what I think I discovered, you know, in talking to a lot of students, not specifically about plagiarism, but just about their lives. You know, these were, you know, millennials who, you know, grew up during the Great Recession and whose parents were rightly enormously concerned about their prospects and really selfish about their success. And so, you know, they came into my class thinking, like, I need to get a major that will pay me money guaranteed, and I have no room to screw up. And so, you know, like maybe whereas generations past, you know, you would have taken your B, your C, your occasional F, and kind of took it on the chin and kept going, knowing that once you graduated, things would probably be fine. These kids didn't seem to have that philosophy. These kids were much more like just worried, just out and out, just full of anxiety about their future, and so like every grade seemed enormously important to them.
It is funny how times shaped that attitude, because I remember when I was before the net-com bubble burst, they did a random sampling of Wall Street brokers who were all kids saying, what do you think a good annual return is? And they all said 30%.
Oh my God.
Because they had never been through any of these cycles.
Right.
And that's another thing about the book, is you're caught up in, like I said in the beginning, I was plagiarizing in my introduction about the raindrop. And you talk about how, you know, we live in this raindrop, but we don't know there is a bucket. We don't know there is an ocean. And you see what I'm saying about how all these things lead to one another and they kind of connect, you know what I mean? That's what.
My hope was that. I mean, I constructed the book really slowly. I mean, it sounds really smart of me when you describe it that way. But the real truth is that I constructed it very, very slowly over a period of a lot of years. And when you write as slowly as I do, there's a lot of opportunity to like kind of make these sort of connections. You know, like to realize that what I'm doing here has some resemblance to something going on over there 300 pages ago. And so I would make a little note to myself, like, when you revise, make sure you add this here, so that when I was all finished, and the thing took, you know, years to revise after I had my first draft was finished in like 2012, 2013.
Wow.
It was 1,002 pages long. And so it took, you know, a good year and a half to kind of go back through there and prune it of all of the various kind of, sub stories that became dead ends for me along the way, and then also to energize some of these connections. So I'm really, really pleased that you saw all of that, and it means that it worked. But but it was really just me kind of stumbling along in the dark and occasionally making some epiphany that I'm sure another writer probably would have seen from the outset.
Well, it's like when Faye is studying and she's reading, whether it's Faye or Alice, when she's reading about Plato in the cave, it's like that,
yeah.
You know? And you're stumbling along in the dark, and what you see isn't the real world, it's something else. And then you drop anvils on people's head during the book, which is also a good sign. Like, for example, Sebastian. I had no idea of anything.
Did you? Really? All right, great.
No. You think I'm dumb because I didn't know?
No, I'm just happy. A friend of mine who was reading an advanced copy recently texted me. He's like, I'm 200 pages from the end, and I think this is going to happen. And he was right. He predicted it. So I'm glad that it did. My intention was to fool people. I'm glad it worked.
Well, now I feel stupid, so I'm disappointing you. I'll have a panic attack on the radio.
Oh, no.
No, I didn't. Well, it's partially because at the beginning, you paint Sebastian. I'm steering away from spoilers of any kind.
Thank you.
But at the beginning, you paint Sebastian in such a way as, he undergoes several, he's like a caterpillar that turns into a butterfly or something else. But at the beginning, you think of him in a certain way, and then that changes, and then you drop an anvil.
I really tried to undermine everybody's first impressions. I mean, the story that I used in Epigraph that you mentioned earlier about the blind men and the elephant, I came to that rather late in the writing, but realized that it was a good expression of what I was trying to do, that those first impressions that you have, are right from your limited point of view, but if you back up far enough, that maybe it's not so correct anymore. I think I make some point later in the book that the thing about the blind men and the elephant is that every man's description of it was correct from their limited point of view. And so, I don't know, I'm reminded of it during this kind of political season that when, I look at people on one side and I just think they're so totally wrong, and they look at me and they're like, how can you be so totally wrong? And just maybe we're just feeling different parts of the elephant.
I had a friend, Chris, and he was a devout fundamentalist Christian. And he was extremely intelligent. He learned Greek so he could read the Bible in Greek.
Wow.
He was like so zen-like that he could, he was my trainer. We ride on the exercise bike and he could lower his heart rate at will. And we always had the same fight. We'd argue in the parking lot after working out, and I'd say, hey, Chris, how can you be so smart and think that God created the world 4,000 years ago and the fossils were put there to test our faith? And he goes, Sam, how can you be so smart and not believe that? That was the beginning and the end of every argument we had.
Right.
And it's, that's the way it works. I mean, that's just the way it works. And you do show that very well with all the characters. I mean, if you go from Samuel to Faye to Henry to Bethany to Bishop to Sebastian to Charlie Brown to Alice, you have these people that have this world view, and you can say, well, none of them are correct at all. They're all wrong, because they are.
Yeah.
But
right,
then at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I started writing this book in 2004, I was living in New York at the time, and it was right, the election was just about to happen, Bush versus Kerry, and I would look at my email and all my friends, and nobody I knew was a Bush voter, and it was just impossible that he would possibly win. That could never happen. And then it did, and we were all shocked. And at the time we had no word for that. Now I know that we were in kind of our own self-manufactured, social media bubble or silo or whatever you call it. But at the time it was just shocking. That something that was such a commonplace among my group of friends was completely wrong among other people. And I remember, really radically changing my thinking about this book. Like, I started it as a really heavy-handed political novel, and then, I really immediately gave that up, and I was thinking, well, what's there's nothing to say that me, from my limited, tiny point of view, somehow has all the right answers about American politics. So let's just do away with that notion and write something much more human. And that was really, really important. I'm glad I didn't write that book that I had originally intended to, because it would be unbearable.
Yeah, I agree. And the thing about it is, what if it happened this time? You know, right now, I long for George W. Bush. I mean, now it seems like, wow, those were the good old days, because if what could happen happens this time, you know, it's like, you know, impossible once again to imagine. But
people have asked me if there's the Wyoming governor Packer in the book who's running for president in the novel, if I base him on the current political season, and it's weird, but I wrote that character like 3 or 4 years ago.
That's what I figured.
At the time I was just like, let's just come up with something silly. And then people are like, you must have based that on the current season. I'm like, no, I really didn't. But it's you know, one of those like truth being stranger than fiction moments.
Well, I hope the person I'm going to talk about isn't listening, but my daughter toured this school that she wanted to attend for secondary education, and the girl who toured with us, the student, was wonderful. She was lovely. And it turns out she was a daughter of somebody I knew. So I called the guy up just to say, you know, you have a wonderful daughter. She's so erudite. She was so kind. She explained everything so well. And he goes, yes, we have a wonderful relationship. Thank you for your remarks. Every morning we get up and have breakfast together. This morning we were talking about Donald Trump. And I was just about to say, what a several expletives. And he goes, yeah, we were both talking about him and saying, what a wonderful father and person he is. And I am so glad, because most of my life has been spent shoving my foot in my mouth repeatedly. And the guy's a nice guy, and his daughter was wonderful. So how is that possible?
Well, you know, I live in Naples, Florida. You're a Floridian, right?
Yes, Gainesville, yeah, the University of Florida. Yeah.
Yeah. So I live in Naples, it's a beautiful, beautiful city. But it's only like 70% conservative, 30% liberal, a lot of my friends are Trump supporters. You know, guys I play tennis with. And I long ago gave up completely trying to be right in political conversations. It just was getting me nowhere. Every time I insisted that I was right, mostly, you know, whoever I was arguing with would insist they were right, and then we'd both come away, you know, more entrenched in our respective positions, and it just didn't seem to do any good. So my approach for years has just been to, just listen, you know, and just try to figure out where people are coming from. It makes me a very poor kind of political advocate, but I think it hopefully makes me a better writer. I'm trying to be more, you know, empathetic to people with whom I might disagree.
Plus, you could just copy down conversations verbatim, like James Joyce did in the Nighttown episode of
Ulysses. Yeah, right. It's convenient.
Yeah, it's really helpful. You don't have to write. You can just have a tape recorder. My problem is I'm really horrible. I'm so outspoken, and I say horrible things. I have bumper stickers. And my mother, who is 94, she's worse than me. And I said, Mom, keep your mouth shut. All your friends are dead. You're the only one alive. You want to be nice to people so that you don't want to do this, because you're going to alienate everybody. And she says, I can say whatever I want. I can be outlandish. I'm 94 years old. I can do whatever I want. I said, yeah, but, you know, I don't know who you're going to end up with. How did you come up with the headmaster?
Oh, the headmaster. Yeah. You know, you're the first person to ask me about him.
Because he's the only real... I'm not going to give it away. He's the only real... Never mind. You just tell me. I interrupted you anyway.
He's another character who's, you know, your initial opinion of him gets undermined later, but in the opposite direction.
Right.
I wanted an authority figure against whom Bishop... one of the kids that Samuel meets when he's 11 could could rebel, you know, like Bishop is a sort of, you know, he's a feisty character. He's he's manipulative. He's a kind of master of bullying, but more like psychological bullying, you know? I don't know, I guess I was just thinking like I needed a reason for him to be that way. And the headmaster, was the way to do that. It made, without giving anything away, it undermined Bishop. I thought it made him come across, you know, like it made his sort of posture more transparent and sort of undermined your first impression of that character. So it sort of worked both ways. I wanted you to have a completely different take on Bishop after you figured out what was going on with the headmaster.
Yeah, it was another anvil that you dropped on my head. But the thing about mm-hmm. it is that part of me was going, he would never let this happen, you know? Mm-hmm. But then I realized, well, that's what happens. And didn't you like, I mean, doesn't a part of you want to be exactly like Bishop?
Yeah, he was fun to write, you know, when he was like talking back to the teachers and teaching a lesson to the biggest, you know, bully in the school. Like, he was really fun to write. And yeah, I mean, there was definitely something about wishing that I could have been this kid when I was 11 years old.
Yeah.
But it was just well beyond me.
The scene with the gate was really cool because I went back and read it three times because I wanted to get the lay of the land, you know? Because I wanted to figure out, okay, so the gate's there and the stairs are there, which kind of lead nowhere, but I can see that they lead nowhere because I've seen that before.
Yeah.
It was really funny because I was interviewing this guy, Arturo Perez Reverte, who wrote this book, What We Become. And he's mm-hmm. Argentinian, but not many of his books have been translated into English. So I had a translator with the interview. And at the end, it was really cool because he goes, "Goodbye, my friend," which I thought was really cool. But he has these scenes where he has this guy on a cruise ship dress impeccably, and he has a Dunhill lighter, and he has this cigarette case, and he has his pockets square and all that. And it's beautifully done, and you can just see every detail of the room, the polish on his shoes. And I said to him, "How do you write so that we can do that?" And he goes, "I don't do it. You do it."
Yeah.
And then I realized that's what I was doing with that scene with you. I said, go ahead.
No, it's funny we don't really. I mean, we just need a couple of key details, and then we fill out the rest in our heads. You know, like. Daniel Mendelsohn, is that right? Who wrote that book about what we think about when we're reading? And he made it.
Yes, I love that book. What we see when we read.
Yeah, that's the one. And he talked about how like he doesn't actually have, you know, an image in his head for, you know, a certain character. Rather, it's more like a feeling around that character. And I love that. And it's really just, you know, you provide a few key details and then you let the reader just kind of run away with those.
Yeah, when I was reading it, I was thinking, well, you know, I read The Fall of the House of Usher, and I know there was this mansion, I know there was this tarn, but do I have an image of my head, in my head, of it? No, I don't. You know, I don't. I just know what it is, but I don't have...
Yeah, this is why I hate... reading a book after I've seen the Hollywood adaptation of that book, because then the Hollywood images sort of infest my head and kind of do all that work for me. I often will put off watching the adaptations until I can read the book.
Me too. And plus, I think we do a better job generally.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, right.
Yeah, it's. But the thing about what I was saying about that scene was, and you must have had a great time writing it because it's so. Funny and, you know, just fun, but is that you can actually see how he did it. You can actually see how he did it, and that's another good part of the book, is that you can see these things happening, like when she goes back,
mm-hmm.
you can see what she sees as opposed, and this is again is the book. You can see what she sees as opposed to what her father saw.
Right.
And I saw both of them.
Yeah. Right.
And you know why? Right. You know why I saw both of them?
Why?
The reason you did it, because of the red paint.
Because of the what?
The red paint.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's that was the detail for you.
That was it. That was what tied the whole...
The farmhouse with the salmon red paint.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that was really well done, too.
Thank you. That's fantastic. You were mentioning those kind of connections and collisions earlier. I loved being able to, when I was describing the school that Bishop, the weird architecture of the school behind by the loading dock with that gate and the stairwell that leads to nowhere. And then later in the book, Faye is at her own school that has its own terrible architecture.
Oh, God.
Right? It's just fun. It was fun for me to be able to do those kinds of moments, it's my hope is, it's a book where, there are two chapters, one's called Revolution and one's called Circle. And then there are some characters who are twins, so it's my hope that, you'll be hearing echoes all over the place. If you read carefully.
Yeah. And then in the acknowledgements, or I guess it's not acknowledgements, when you look to your sources, the book regarding the architecture of the circle and all that.
Yeah.
We have this building company too, and our architects, sometimes I get so upset with them because everything they do is beautiful, but it's like, I said, what you're doing? You're doing function following form. You're not doing form following function. They get really, really angry at me.
Is that right?
But that's what happened there, right? I mean,
Yeah. You
go up these stairs expecting to be able to get somewhere and you find, oh no, I have to go back downstairs and down this ugly hallway that's blocked from sunlight because of these columns. And sometimes.
Yeah, I really did. I spent, for anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about, Faye goes to University of Chicago, University of Illinois at Chicago, and back in the late 60s, it was called University of Illinois Chicago Circle, and everybody just called it Circle. And it followed this, at the time, really avant-garde, I think it's called brutalist architectural style, that involves a lot of, concrete and, really big forms. But walking around it now, it's just so unpleasant. I spent several summer afternoons walking around the campus when school was not in session just to kind of get a feel for it. And once I walked through the Behavioral Sciences Center, I think is where her class is located, it was just, the thing was just dizzying, There really were, stairwells leading to landings that had identical stairwells, surrounding them in an octagonal shape where you had really no idea. There's nothing to clue you in about where you should go. The place was just a mess to navigate. And I was like, this is perfect. This perfectly captures how Faye would be feeling in college, having to navigate what she has to navigate.
It reminded me of Borges Library or M.C. Escher painting or the stairways in Hogwarts.
Perfect. I love that. Yeah, that's perfect.
All right, well, I was going to go on to Charlie Brown, but that would be a horrible way to end the interview because he's just so despicable. But you don't really have a lot of despicable people because Faye's father is not despicable at all, and you make that clear.
No. Yeah, he made it, like most of the characters, he made a mistake, and he's been regretting it since, but you understand why he made the mistake, I hope.
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's a couple of reasons, I think. One is because of his abilities. That would be one. I get close to this point. But if you think about people who made choices, you got Samuel made the wrong choice. Faye, Henry, who knows whether he made... Yeah, Henry made the wrong choice, sure.
Yeah, sure.
Bishop did, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Brown made the wrong one. Freya, who's... marginally, yeah. Did not make the wrong choice.
No, she's she becomes kind of the voice of maturity.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And my hope is that she and I think Alice to a degree, Alice as an older character, both seem to have kind of gone through certain darknesses, gone through the fire, and come out with knowledge that the characters, the main characters in the book, have not yet attained.
Well, Freya, she almost gives the benediction of the book, whereas Alice is just stuck with the mustard. And
Yeah, it's true.
And she still she still regrets that she's not doing what her hardcore radical people think she should be doing. So I think the best is by saying, go home, it's the end of our visit, shake hands, this is the end of our visit. That was a good job, too.
Yeah, thanks.
This is the end of our visit. Go home. Everything's okay. Go home, yeah. And everything will be as it should be. And then there's Bethany, who I don't even know whether she was flawed or not. Do you?
Of course she was, but Samuel could never see it. You know, he was so, you know, blinded by his own, you know, big R romantic idealization of her that he couldn't see her truthfully. So she was flawed, but of course Samuel couldn't see it.
Okay, here's how we'll end this. Okay, because we've been talking for an hour, which seems like it just flew by. So sound. When Bethany gives her discourse on, you know, when you hit a piece of wood, the door jamb, it's brown and muddy. But behind that, there's all these different sounds. And then you go to Allen Ginsberg and the Om. And so the book is suffused with sound. And then I was thinking about it. So, okay, the book is about sound. And as I said in the beginning, we all hear these sounds, and we all hear different sounds. So this is what I was talking about when I was saying how these layers of the book, which goes back to the John Barth kind of feel, or the Don DeLillo kind of feel. So what to you was the reason why, if indeed you did, make sound such an important aspect of the book, knowingly?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I know a lot of it was sort of seat of the pants gut feeling, you know.
Yeah.
You know, like the Ginsberg example, like he very famously, you know, really did sit on the lawn in Grant Park during the riots in 1968 and went om and you know, as a kind of cry for peace. Like that's just a true thing, and so it seemed natural to include the om and that kind of the music of that chanting. But of course, you know, Bethany is a musician. She's a violinist, and so to add kind of, you know, her music was an obvious choice. I don't know if I could, you know, anything more than that, it would be like Monday morning quarterbacking for me. I'd have to say like it felt right, it felt true, and it felt like, you know, one of those like sensual details that I felt like would present itself to the reader's body. Like I always tell my writing students, as much as you can, like try to write through the body, try to write through the senses, and of course sound is one of those senses. So it's something that I just try to infuse the book with.
Yeah, that's a good explanation.
I hope so. It's the best I can do.
Well, I just realized that can't be the last question. I have to ask one more question, then we'll say goodbye.
Okay.
Well, right. I know we never discussed what the title means.
Oh, my God, you're right.
So you got to go through that. I'll go through that, and then I'll leave you be.
Okay. Well, a Nyx is a kind of a folkloric, spiritual, ghost-like being from Scandinavian folklore. It's known as, you know, in various places it has different names. It's known as a Nek or a Nixie or a Nokin or a Nix. I picked Nix because even though that's technically a German name for it, I like the kind of double meaning of the word Nix as it applies to this book. So a Nix is, in the Norwegian version of this of that tale, a Nix is usually described as a sort of troll-like beast that lurks in the water, but every once in a while it will appear to children as a beautiful white horse, and it'll try to entice the children to climb aboard, and if they do, it'll gallop them into the water and drown them. And it's one of several tales from Norwegian folklore that Faye's father tells her as she's growing up, and then she in turn tells Samuel when he's growing up, and she invents a different meaning to what the story of the Nix, what the kind of the moral is of the Nix. She thinks that it means that things you love the most can someday hurt you the worst, because, you know, these kids, when they're presented with their very own horse for the first time, it must be like the best moment of their lives, you know, like nothing this big has ever minded them before. It must be amazing. But then that's of course before what happens, and by then it's too late. So that moral, that things you love the most can sometimes hurt you the worst, seemed important to me because Well, it's happening to all the characters who are undermined by things that mean the most to them. You know, Samuel by his mother, and Pwnage by his video game, and Laura by the devices and apps that give her life meaning. And even Henry is undermined by the job that he's devoted his life to.
TV dinners.
So it just seemed to be a guiding principle as I develop these characters.
Yeah, and it's like the basement, the stone, the horse, the jail. Those are all four. And, you know, when I was in college, and I will have to say, sometimes in altered states of consciousness, the thing that gets you the most, and this goes to your puzzle analogy, is when you look at something and it seems to be the most wonderful thing in the world, and then gradually, like the stone, it changes and changes and changes until what you thought was the most wonderful thing in the world is the most thing most filled with horror that you can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And that's because at first it's not, it's a puzzle, and then it becomes a trap. And generally you can't get out of it.
That's a great way to put that. Yeah, you don't know it's a trap until it's too late, because that's the trap.
Well, it may not be the most ebullient way to end the interview, but
it's a very eloquent way to do it, though.
Well, so I asked you questions you won't get asked most of the time, right?
Yeah, those were great. Those were really fantastic. Thank you.
Well, I wish you I don't have to wish you the best, because the best has happened to you, but be very careful. Remember.
I don't want to end up at the crawl screen on CNN. Is that right?
Yeah. But no, I'm very happy for you. And now that I've talked to you, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. And
thanks.
I think you got all kinds of things, great things coming in the near future and in the rest of your life. So thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk to you today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
That was Nathan Hill talking to us about The Knicks, his new novel, which was just released last week, which has received tremendous publicity, rightfully so. And it's a novel that's reminiscent of the best of John Barth, of Don DeLillo, of John Irving. John Irving compares him to Charles Dickens. I don't know whether I'd go that far, but it was a wonderful interview, at least on his part. When I wasn't talking, I had a great deal of fun speaking with him, and highly, highly, highly recommend the book. So as I always say, join us every week on The Avid Reader. We have Amor Towles, one of my favorite authors who wrote The Rules of Civility, which I interviewed him for, it seems like, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 years ago. And now his highly anticipated second novel, The Gentleman in Moscow, is out. And we'll be interviewing him regarding that, which is a completely different book. But literarily, his language, his voice, his erudition almost make a plot unnecessary. The driving force of his work is his narrative. We'll also be interviewing Patrick Flannery to discuss his latest I Am No One, which was a really cool book, and Michael Honig, who will share The Senility of Vladimir P., which is about silly but really good. What happens when Vladimir Putin gets Alzheimer's disease? So those are three good ones coming up, at least three. So join us every week, like I said, and if you want to look for our complete schedule, you can visit us at our new website, still wellingtonscrubbooks.com, but totally revamped. I revamped it, so anything bad about it is due to me. Or you can look at WCHE's schedule, or you can simply download our podcasts at iTunes or Podomatic. And I try to keep up with them, but I lost the person who was uploading them. And since I'm so lazy, they may be a week or two behind. But I'm doing my best to get up there. So anyway, thank you as always. I had a pleasure with Nathan Hill today regarding his brand new book, The Knicks. We will see you next week here on The Avid Reader.